Thank you, Anne. Delighted to see you again, and very thankful for the invitation, even though I'm a little bit apprehensive, and thank you to Sunny as well for the invitation to be here. My apprehension comes from the fact that, of course, I've not been to a math meeting or institute for a good number of years. So, by the way, I think about that when Anne and I were in grad school at Berkeley back in the days. You know, she used to run circles around me at every step of the way. So I think she's missed that feeling for a few years, and now she thought to call me back so that we take a break to, for the sake of good old times, she can give me a good old-fashioned beating. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about nanotechnology, and I have certainly two sections in my presentation that I would like to cover. I may actually have a last appendix, depending on time. So most people, with the exception of hermits, and you must have heard of nano this and nano that, it's become a very fashionable word, of course, so let me not take too much of your time describing what it is. Of course, you know, for those of you that are biologically minded, the notion that within 10 to 100 nanometer range, you find very complex, multifunctional molecules, such as, of course, antibodies all the way up to viruses for an HIV virus of the order of perhaps 100 nanometers. So the complexity of function that can be packed by biology into those dimensional ranges is staggering. And of course, with human artifacts, we don't come anywhere near that, but we are starting to scratch the surface a little bit, and I would like to discuss that. Of course, as you know, another, the prefix nano has been reported to be a Greek word that it means apt to bring in dollars from Washington, D.C. So with that, and in view of the Darwinian dynamics of academic population evolution, everyone has tried to kind of define nanotechnology in slightly different ways. So I give you my personal, not that it's any better than anybody else's, but just to give a little bit of my bias about this, which actually appeared in Nature Nanotechnology, the inaugural issue a couple of years ago. So in my mind, to have something which is qualifies as nanotechnological, it's obvious that you have to have the device itself, or one of its crucial components, has to be on the nanoscale, as we defined earlier. Second, it has to be man-made. Otherwise, we call this molecular biology or all sorts of other things. It has to be synthetic, it has to be man-made. Third, he has to have what we call emerging properties, new properties, just making something big, making it small. If it has the same properties, it doesn't excite us as much. So you have to have an emerging properties. And so these three components are essentially everybody's in agreement with that. Where I start getting tomatoes thrown at me at nanotechnology meetings is on the fourth part, which I thought I would show to you in view of the fact that, of course, there's so much mathematics in this room. Essentially, without much academic eloquence, the expression is, it ain't nano if you don't have the math to back it up. What do I mean by that? Hard as it is to make things at the nanoscale, believe me, it's a lot harder to measure things at the nanoscale. So unless you have some sort of a constructive proof that the emerging behavior that you observe has some reason for being there, you find yourself somewhat like people that develop drugs, that develop new molecules. You can observe effects to a certain extent, but unless you have a mechanism of action, you are not reaping the full benefits. And I'm being benign, the reality is that I'm finding that a lot of the nanotechnology literature essentially is based on the triumph of the outlier data over the distributionally meaningful, or things that are not that they even have citizenship in science. So it ain't nano if you don't have the math to back it up. And that is a little bit of the story that I would like to discuss with you today. I've actually followed up and I've been thinking about this a little bit. Actually I have a few copies of this if anybody is interested. I wrote an essay at the beginning of the year for this journal called Small. Now I officially made a small contribution to science. So this journal called Small, Chad Merkin's journal, is actually a great journal, this it was before I started writing in it. And so the mathematical engines of nanomedicine, I find the mathematics is a fundamental component of nanotechnology, of nanomedicine in particular. And I kind of wrote a little scherzo, if you will, around these four theses that I will come back to in the course of my presentation. Math is a compass. the forest of complexities of potential choices that you have as you make your nanotechnological devices is absolutely astronomical. Actually, I'm jealous of astronomy because they have the word astronomical. It's a nanotechnologicomical or whatever. It's tremendous. And unless you have good mathematical guidance, you're dead in the woods. Second, as you do math and you start to observe and kind of study phenomena a little bit, you find out unexpected things that can lead you, they may be surprising in the sense that they contradict some of your preconceived notions or dogmas, but then all of a sudden, as you recognize those, of course, you open up new frontiers and new horizons. A big, tremendous problem in using math for nano is that you have to bridge across multiple different scales, which you can do in a number of different ways, and I don't mean to give a compendium or a lecture on that, I don't know that I will be able to, but that will point to a couple of different approaches that we've been working with. And as you saw, to me, math is at the very core of nanotechnology. It ain't nano if you don't have the math to back it up. To give a little bit more of my personal bias, you know, I think Anne has told you already that we were grad students together at Berkeley, actually came from Italy with training in mathematical physics. I stayed at Berkeley for about 10 years on the faculty, and I got my tenure there in civil, in materials, engineering both, and I was part of the committee that established biomedical engineering. I then migrated from the People's Republic of Berkeley to the frozen tundras of Ohio, where I was a professor and a chair of the new Department of Biomedical Engineering for about 6 years. As part of that, I spent 2 years at the end of the six at the National Cancer Institute, where my job was to put together the national program in nanotechnology applied to cancer. I will make reference to that a little bit. And since I moved to the lovely city of Houston, Texas, where I have multiple appointments, the primary appointment is at the University of Texas and at the MD Anderson Cancer Center, which are the two places where I have tenure. The rest are adjoint or adjunct professorships. The reason why I have so many, I think one is that nobody wants to have me 100% time. That's the real reason. But other reasons have to do with the fact that we have in Houston a consortium called the Alliance for Nanohealth, which is a consortium of 8 institutions, and I'm leading that, and as part of that, I need to have traction with the multiple institutions, so that's the way my appointment was designed. First example that I'd like to talk to you about, which has to do with transport of some sorts, is these things that we call nanochannel delivery systems, or NDSs, which are therapeutic implants, implants that we put under the skin so that they will release bioactive molecules or drugs in accordance with the prescribed release profile. This is funded by a number of different things, and we have a spin-off in which I declare a financial interest is defined, significant financial interest is defined by the federal government. Not as significant if you ask me, but that's a different story. At the point of contention. So back in the Berkeley days, when I was on the faculty at Berkeley, those were the days some of you may have, yes, I'm sure you heard the expression MEMS, microelectromechanical systems. Those were the early days of MEMS. That's MEMS technology was essentially emerging at Berkeley and MIT. And these had to do with using microelectronics fabrication technology to make micromechanical devices. And I became interested in looking at those for biomedical applications, and we established the first BioMEMS laboratory that I know of, and that was at Berkeley. No, those were the days that microfluidics and DNA chips and all sorts of different technologies now become common parlance that were originating from those days. So not being smart enough to do what was mainstream, which was microfluidics, for whatever reason that I'm too embarrassed to go into, we started doing nanofluidics right away, which of course now a bunch of people are doing 10, 15 years later. But back in 1995, we were making nanochannels in silicon membranes. We got about 30 different patents on how to make these things. So making channels of very controlled geometry and very controlled surface chemistry so that you could then diffuse molecules or transport molecules across these channels, across the membranes. And these membranes, again, they are made out of silicon, essentially, on silicon wafers, and I can tell you more about how you make those if you're interested. But operationally speaking, the reason why I'm interested in those is because I can mounted on a little tube that contains drugs. And then I can use this membrane as a release port, so that then, of course, the transport of the drug into the body in which it is implanted is metered by the properties of the nanochannels, on which we have great control. In a more modern version than the one that you saw that dates back to 1994, we have developed what we call NDS systems, which rather than being through a vertical membranes, have this type of a configuration, a sandwich configuration, you get wafer, wafer, and there is a stricture, a nano-sized stricture here in the diffusional path of these molecules, which actually takes place in a way that we don't need to go into too much of a detail on, but essentially through a serpentine type of arrangement that optimizes the number of actual channels. They're looking at this from the top now, through which your molecules can diffuse. And again, from atomic force microscopy, you see these are the anchors, essentially, in which the top and the bottom channels are bonded to one another. And these are the areas which comprise your channel region through which mass transport takes place. And again, this is a cartoon that kind of illustrates how this works, but you get the idea already. So let me move on to the next. Why do I care about that? Well, you know, so first you make them, and then you start testing them, and you start diffusing from a reservoir into an acceptor well molecules, and you measure the cumulative amount released over time. And lo and behold, over weeks and months, this is lysozyme, but they can give you the same data for maybe 20 different molecules, drugs or drug model molecules. You observe an essentially linear release profile. So think about this, you put it under the skin, it releases linearly same amount of drug per unit time for weeks and months at a time, which is actually a very helpful thing to have for a number of medical indications. One example could be, for instance, for the treatment of hepatitis type C. If you release interferon, slow, small dosage, long period of time, stimulates the immune system to combat, you know, the viral infection. Interferon, if given the way it is usually given for treatment of hepatitis C, 3 injections per week for 6 months to a year type of regimen, every time you get a shot, you get very sick for a couple of days. So much so that a lot of people drop off treatment, because no, hepatitis C will not kill you right away. It will kill you by like cancer of the liver maybe 10, 15 years out. And so sometimes the perspective is not sufficient to keep people on treatment. Same line of argument for many other diseases and drug combinations. So the notion of having linear release can be useful. And of course, there are a number of other technologies that do similar things, but that's not the point of this talk. Now, great. So you see that and you say, man, we got something. And then all of a sudden, you wake up in the middle of the night in cold sweat saying, I got what I wanted, but this was not supposed to happen. Anybody remember Fick's law? Fick's law in the experimental conditions that we're talking about gives you, by necessity, an exponential type of curve, which, you know, a lot of drug release per unit time here and not enough here. So how do we, is this in contradiction with what I should have expected? Well, it turns out that it isn't, but it wasn't very, we were not smart enough to see why. And it took us quite a bit of time to realize what the actual mechanism was. The reality is that Fick's law, of course, derives or obtains from Brownian agitation of molecules for thermal agitations, that was Einstein's thesis, under the specific assumption that the thermal agitation be three-dimensionally unconstrained. If that is imposed, then from Brownian motion follows Fick's law. In our case, obviously, that's not where we are. Now, the molecules are essentially half, one-third, but same order of magnitude as the channel height. And under those conditions, the importance of the molecules sticking to the wall and being released in this reversible different kinetics type of phenomena actually produce a slowing down, if you will, effectively, that you see a profile such as that. And that is, of course, the hand-waving explanation. Now, let's see if you can actually build some math into that. It turns out that a generalized form of Fick's law has been developed, and the gentleman that developed that is called Peskir, is a mathematician at the University of Manchester in England, who developed this formulation, which, as you notice, reduces to Fick's law if you put these parameters A and B equal zero. Now, with a suitable choice of these two parameters, you are able to reproduce a linear type of cumulative release profile, and you know, with my engineering training, I was really pretty happy with that, because man, I can fit to experimental data A and B, and I'm home. Actually, it turns out, meeting a bunch of people that were a lot smarter than we were, that practiced the discipline of molecular dynamics, it turns out that these parameters A and B can be calculated without any reference whatsoever to experiment from first principles, essentially from molecular dynamics, by simplifying the molecule of interest, again in this case being lysozyme, and simulating with molecular dynamics its interaction with a row of atoms, in this case representing the silicon surface that we're working with, and seeking certain energy minima and identifying what is A and B said to be, then you get your A and B for the molecule and the surface of interest, and you can vary both if you are so inclined. You put them in here, you discretize, and you get, essentially, you see the experimental and the theoretical curve are in excellent agreement. As a matter of fact, the green is the predicted curve, in, I would say, very strong agreement. Again, keep in mind that the green curve was obtained without any reference to experiment whatsoever. The fitting is this dashed red line, which is closer, but that's what fitting is supposed to be. So why am I telling you the story? Oh, before I come to that. So this was actually the example, the experience, if you will, that informs my definition for nanotechnology. You see a special emerging property, in this case a diffusional property, that happens because of the nanoscale nature of your artifact, which in this case is a channel. And we have a mechanistic explanation for that, and it's comforting that actually could think about using this for medical applications. What kind of medical applications? I've given you one. There's many others that we are developing. This company, Nanomedical System, is actually developing very, very, very aggressively. However, one that perhaps may be fun to talk about, we are in Houston, Texas. You remember the Houston, Texas, we have NASA. So we have a big contract from NASA. The folks at NASA have been given the challenge to land humans on Mars by year 2031. With the expectation that said humans will return from Mars alive, which is the harder part of this proposition. All right, so 9 months, it takes 9 months to go to Mars, 12 months to come back, Presumably you stay a few months on Mars. Not a simple story. Not a simple story for a number of reasons, including availability of medical care, not very prompt. For obvious reasons. So the folks at NASA gave us essentially this pretty big grant, a $4 million grant, saying, can you help us design a system that will integrate the immune system and the endocrine system of astronauts so that you can supplement the functions that all of us have built in so that we can address the needs for extensive deep space exploration times? Such as, how do you deal with all the radiation that comes in? How do you deal with the fact that all this and that and the other? So, and of course, you know what we are talking about here. So the notion is that we are developing these capsules for implantation for the release of anti-radiation agents and a number of other things. It actually turns out, if you are so interested, it turns out that if you apply a field across the nanochannels, transport, you can control transport in an active fashion. The physics underlying that is what is known as electroosmosis. It's kind of like electrophoresis, but not really. It's an entirely different physical phenomenon. So electroosmosis with these nanochannel systems actually takes place with a very, very low energy expenditure. So that essentially the battery that one would use for the pacemaker could actually last for the extent of travel to Mars and back. And what can you do once you have an active mechanism for control? Well, you can thinking about doing active release from pre-programming, you can say every day at a certain hour, you can perhaps you can reproduce a circadian rhythm, even in deep space type of situation, or the regulatory hormones, and there's all sorts of different applications. So pre-programmed or remotely activated to counter an emergent situation, such as a situation of shock. Or self-regulated, of course, is the ultimate objective, to have something that acts like secretory glands in the body that respond to a stimulus that can be chemical, can be physical, or can be biomolecular. This is, of course, the harder thing of the three. But this is a program that we are actually investigating and continuing to work on. And by the way, these things are motivated and funded by of course, space medicine type of applications. But I think we could all recognize the possible uses for these type of technologies on planet Earth, which is my ultimate objective. I would like to work for NASA, but my mind is set to civilian medicine as a top priority. Second example, which is actually the way I advertised this talk when I sent in my topic, is the notion of using nanovectors or nanoparticles that carry drugs and therapeutic principles and imaging contrast agents to select the locations in the body. And this is probably the biggest program that we have in my laboratory. And again, I'm declaring here the financial interest in this company called Leonardo Biosystems. And I forgot to put in that company is also part of a portfolio of a publicly traded company on NASDAQ called Arrowhead. Arrowhead is ARWR is the ticket, in case you're interested. And it is in Pasadena, so it's short ways from there. And I'm the scientific director of the company, director of scientific strategy. All right, so let's talk about now, let's change. Now I'm thinking about particles that can carry drugs or active principles to locations in the body. I'll make reference to tumors just because I spend most of my time in an oncology setting. I wrote this big review, and if anybody is interested, Cancer Nanotechnology in 2005, and some of the materials that I will show you comes from that review, including the notion of nanovector. So what am I calling a nanovector? Well, it would be a particle that comprises active principles, perhaps more than one, that comprises potentially imaging contrast agents, so that your radiological investigations can be aided in terms of anatomical contours, but also in terms of molecular composition analysis, the latter being done with biological recognition moieties, which decorate the surface of the particle. An additional component that you see here that we need to talk about is this little wiggle thing. This is the representative of polyethylene glycol, which is a molecule that we use on injected particles so that they will not be picked up by the reticular endothelial system, by the activated monocytes, by macrophages in the filtering organs of the body, such as the spleen, the liver, and the lungs. So, this is kind of like a summary conceptual thing, but you know, when I was at the NCI those 2 years, we were developing a catalog for many nano different. You all know somebody who does nanoparticles, probably already you do nanoparticles yourself. The census that I was keeping at the NCI counted more than 5,000 different nanoparticles under development, some of which I'll tell you are in the clinic. So the notion of taking 100 of them, your favorite 100, simple thing. Hours, most promising 100 different nanoparticles, the materials. Pick 10 different volumes, 10 different aspect ratios if you don't want to make them spherical, 100 different targeting moieties, get your catalog of antibodies and monoclonals, 100 different drugs, that's easy. Put them all together combinatorially, how many choices did you get? Oh, it's unbelievable. Unbelievable. So this maps to the notion that I was talking about earlier, about using math as a compass. Let's look into the drug development world. People start with pharmaceutical companies when they want to come up with a new drug. They will typically look at the receptor that they want to target. And so they look at molecules that have something that docks well with that particular receptor. And they develop combinatorial libraries that have that docking element. 10 to the 6, 10 to the 8 possible variations. We are talking 100 million, a billion different variations on something with the same docking molecule. But of course, they wouldn't dream of testing all of the above. It would be impossible. You would start in cell lines, then go to animals, then go to bigger animals, then go into people. It's impossible. So the vast majority of the deselection, if you will, is done by mathematics. It's done through methods of molecular dynamics that essentially look at a number of different factors of what happens after you do the docking. We don't have that in nanotechnology. And think about the fact that each of those 10 to the 6 or 10 to the 8 can be the starting active principles around which you can put 10 to the however many different nanoparticles. So the numbers are truly astronomical, and we don't have the math to do the deselection in an intelligent fashion. In the wonderful medical center in Houston, Texas, that of course was referred to earlier on, or from other places in the world, I get weekly calls and letters and emails of people saying, this patient, this disease, this stage, this molecular presentation, what nanoparticle should I use? The answer is, I don't have a clue. Anybody that tells you that they got a clue, they don't know what they are talking about. That's the reality. So here is the notion, math is a compass for selection and for intelligent, I was going to say intelligent design. And for rational design, shall we say, of the particle. So where are we with nanotechnology in the clinic? Sometimes I go out, I give like that. Recently given a plenary at the American Association for Cancer Research to 5,000 cancer doctors. Try to go stand in front of 5,000 cancer doctors and say, look, I used to be a professor of civil engineering, and I actually trained in mathematics, and let me tell you how we're going to cure cancer. That can be very unfriendly as an opening statement. So one thing that I've learned is that you need to make friends right away. So the first thing I do, I say, look, you may not know it, but you have been using nanoparticles in your clinic every day for the last 10 years. Even though you never call them nanoparticles. However, that's what liposomes are. Liposomes are the paradigmatic archetypal nanoparticle. About 100 nanometers across, fat little globules with drugs inside. And you inject them in general circulation, and they find a way to concentrate in the tumors. I'll tell you why in a moment. And these have been approved about 10 years ago for Kaposi sarcoma, but now they're becoming very pervasive in cancer therapy, ovarian cancer, breast cancer, especially metastatic and recurrent. There are over 150 clinical trials going on for combination therapy using liposomes, so there is a huge number of different liposomal strategies. These are very simple, dumb nanoparticles. Another nanoparadoxil is the trade name of one pegylated nanoparticle that carries around adriamycin or doxorubicin, also known as the Red Death, one of those very aggressive drugs. That is good once it hits the tumor. Unfortunately, it carries significant cardiotoxicity, so you want to concentrate it in the tumor. Another family, nanoparticles that are actually albumin nanoparticles that contain another famous drug, Taxol. This has become available 3 years ago and is taking the breast cancer market by storm. So these particles also essentially, you may have seen it, or you may know that, you know, as your patient goes into the later stages of the tumor growth, their albumin tanks. You get the albumin readings, they really go very, very low because the tumor is really picking up as much albumin as possible. So hey, let's put the nanoparticle made of albumin, let's put a drug, Trojan horse strategy, in the clinic for about 3 years now. So these are examples. In the pipeline, moving to clinical applications in preclinical, but several of these in actual clinical studies already, so FDA approved for clinical studies, there are several other more exciting, more, if you will, more multifunctional strategies. Let me just point to a couple. These nanoparticle made of iron oxide, which is a negative contrast agent for MRI. So you can inject it, and if it concentrates in the tumor, then you see your tumor, the anatomical contours more easily. The surgeon can go in and remove it more easily. If you put an antibody around it, for instance, a biological recognition moiety, you can learn something about the makeup of the tumor. Problem with tumors is that you can never find two of them that are alike, kind of like snowflakes, the molecular presentations, man. So the notion that you need to be able to develop some sort of a personalizing of the therapy that you use for hitting the tumor. Personalization of therapy in oncology is not only a good idea, the only way to actually make significant headway against tumor in my personal cancer, in my personal opinion. So this thing right here, it's got its antibodies, you inject it, it goes in the right place, It's a negative contrast stage, the darkness, you see your film, so you know where the tumor is. Good. A bunch of people found out that if you, your repulse sequence that you use for activating, of course, for recording your image, if you actually switch it to very quick back and forth, north and south, the poor little nanodomains inside of the particle, they have to realign very quick. In their boundaries, they have to frictional heating. So not only you see, so this thing heats up with appropriate pulse sequence. So not only you see where the tumor is, but you can switch the pulse sequence and you cook it. There's one group in clinical trials, cool idea, isn't it? There's a group in clinical trials for glioblastoma multiforme. If there's one cancer you don't want to have, is GBM. GBM in Germany, this is a group, great group in Berlin, the company is called MagForce. There is a company in the US called Triton, which I think is finding its way into clinical trials. So this is a cool idea. The notion of remotely activated triggering with an external energy, triggering of therapeutic action, physical action. There is no notion of resistance against cooking. No drugs, no, the tumors develop what they call resistance to drugs, but you can't develop resistance to cooking. Similar, you can do similar things with gold nanoshells or gold nanoparticles. You can activate them with near-infrared light or with radio frequency or with ultrasound. So this notion of remotely activated has become very popular. There are a lot of exciting different things. This multifunctional nanoparticle, a polymer-based, this comes from the University of Michigan, James Baker, this carries a drug, also carries a targeting agent, also carries an imaging contrast agent, so you see where, you can, where your drugs is going. So you can have some feedback about whether you're using the right drug or the right particle for the right patient. Without usually what we do now, we give people these regimens of the very damaging drugs, then we wait 3 months, then we do another MRI and we look if the tumor shrunk or not. No, that's a lot of suffering, there is a lot of unnecessary disasters that happen because of that strategy, so the notion of being able to monitor is a good idea. So I told you the liposomes end up in the tumor, why do they do that? Well, because tumors in certain phases of the growth, cancer tumors, develop, they all invariably develop a phenomenon called neoangiogenesis, that is the growth of new blood vessels that will allow them to continue the growth. And the new blood vessels, as they are formed, they present with a very disorderly architecture. And in particular, the blood vessel wall, the vascular endothelial wall, is disorganized and it presents with this, in this cartoon you see these fenestrations or gaps or openings that make the vasculature hyperpermeable. So if you have a particle the right size, boom, it will sneak in. Healthy doesn't sneak in. Two more, boom, it goes in. So it's a differential concentration mechanism. Number of problems with this idea? No, this is just a phase. Then they renormalize, especially if you treat your patients with anti-angiogenic drugs. The first thing that goes is the fenestration, but that's a good starting point. If you don't believe the cartoon, perhaps you can look at the images, perhaps they can help get the point across, normal, tumor, anastomosis. The flow characteristics are very different, very sluggish, and all sorts of features that you would not expect, including little holes. Or these, I don't know, even how would you call this, no, little mountains or whatever. So stuff that you wouldn't expect. So that's a barrier, but that's also an advantage. So far I've hinted at two explicit, very important barriers that the body puts up against being penetrated by a foreign body in the form of a nanoparticle or a molecule that's not supposed to be there. It can be a toxin, it can be some sort of a poison. Body is not set up pretty good, huh? So the moment you inject, say, a nanoparticle or a foreign molecule is not supposed to be there in the bloodstream, first thing, first level of defense, enzymatic degradation. Then opsonization follows, which leads to uptake by these reticular endothelial cells system that I was mentioning earlier. Endothelial and epithelial barriers getting from the bloodstream into the tumor, very, very difficult. Gets worse. Well, the very same, the very dynamics of flow, it doesn't help. And I'll talk about this in greater detail in a moment. As a tumor grows, the internal hydrostatic pressure, osmotic, oncotic pressure, grows. Interstitial pressure grows. So your particle doesn't want to go from the bloodstream into the tumor. It's actually the other way around. So for macromolecules or for nanoparticles, very bad news. All you got is diffusion. Big particle doesn't like to diffuse as much. Even if you make it across and you go across, of course, not the tissue parenchyma somehow, you want to get into the cell, you have to negotiate cell membrane. Even if you do, you know, kind of like a sinking boat, you see the guys with the bucket pulling out the water. There are mechanisms, ionic and molecular pumps, that are set up, also known as multi-drug resistance mechanisms, that are essentially set up to empty the cell from toxins. Nuclear membrane, if you want to get into the nucleus, very complicated. So my statement is, following these few years of thinking about this, is that the real advantage of nanotechnology is not so much in biological targeting. It can be convenient for that as well. But the real paradigmatic shift, if you will, is on the avoidance of biological barriers. These come to you one after the other. We need to be able to have sequential mechanisms for dealing with them. You have to open every door. You got 10 doors, you have to open on 10. Opening 9 doesn't do you much good. So with that concept under our belt, let's look at what I think 3 generations of nanotech are. First, the dumb passive EPR targeted particles already in the clinic, great. You can reinvent liposomes using any number of other materials, and that's what a lot of people do. I don't think you're buying yourself any real competitive advantage. That is my personal perspective. Second generation, biomolecular targeting, remote activation, there is something more there. And that's very important, and they are moving up into the pipeline. Third generation, this is the game changer. Higher function, sequential action, bringing in the action of multiple different particles. And that is the state, there are several examples of this. We are very active on that on a system that we call multi-stage system, which is what I really want to talk about. So rationally designed multi-stage nanovectors, and again, this is funded by a number of different things. And here's the illustrative cartoon. So I'm injecting a particle that you will notice, a family of particles that you will notice is not spherical. It's disc-like in this particular case. You will see one in a moment. And that particle will navigate through the bloodstream, and it will find a way to land preferentially on the vascular endothelium. You see it right here. Vascular endothelium in a healthy fashion, to get from here into the tumor, either go through the cells, which is very difficult to do, if not impossible, because of resident enzymes and endocytosis and all sorts of different things, or you can go through in between paracellular transport, which usually is rendered very difficult by the fact that the cells are tightly joined to one another through, of course, tight junctions. So the notion of being able to co-release permeation enhancers such as local toxins, reversible toxins, that will open up these junctions so that you can get in. Or perhaps agents that can make these metalloproteinases, for instance, they can look how it digests the basement membrane so you can have a second wave of particle come in. Once you get here, the nanoparticles of the first and second generation are great. Liposomes are the best in negotiating the cell membrane. They fuse, they release their payload in the cytoplasm, but also nanotubes, all sorts of other different things. Once you get them here, it's good. So I look at myself as the taxi driver of the nanomedicine world. People get in and say, where do you want to go? And I tell them, and I try to bring them to the right vasculature and help them get across the vasculature wall, which puts me actually strategically in a nice position because I'm not competing with anybody. I'm just trying to help anybody that's got a particle that can make any sense. So, and as you see here, a particular application where the liposomes contain siRNA so that you can get in, which is actually the primary direction of development for us. But now, okay, how do I get here? That's the problem. Turns out, we have broken down the process, and I'll tell you who we is. We've broken down the process following a little bit of the hints that come from physiology, leukocytes. Into 3 steps. Margination, moving from inside to the blood vessel wall. Firm adhesion, just the fact that you land and the antibody sticks to an antigen doesn't mean it's going to stay there. As a matter of fact, if the drug is strong enough, just means it's going to take the antigen with itself or perhaps a piece of the cell membrane or what have you. Third, uptake by endocytosis, receptor-mediated endocytosis or phagocytosis uptake, internalization. So we have spent a number of years, now we say, with this gentleman by the name of Paolo De Cuzzi, who sends you his best wishes, who is a professor with me at UT. I brought him in from Italy, of all places. So we spent a number of years analyzing these three processes so that we could actually come up with prescriptions for the optimal design of the particles, which is what fits hopefully to the theme of this meeting. So that's the whole idea, these three steps. I asked him, Paolo, I get all these clinicians, they're asking me what nanoparticle to use for this and that. Can you tell me what is the best size and shape and charge and density and the physical properties such as modulus that I can use for a nanoparticle? And his answer was, then was, I got no clue. And his answer now is my answer as well, I still got no clue. But that's where some unpleasant discoveries were made. And I will point to you, I point you to some of those. First, let's make it simple. Margination dynamics spherical particles, without getting into the details of how this is done, is essentially force balance type of analysis. Margination time, once you get in the right capillary, you want to marginate as quickly as possible. This will translate into the highest possible probability of hitting the antigen or hitting the fenestration that you want. All right, so of all possible sizes for spherical particles, the worst possible is about 100 nanometers. Oh, and given that the vast majority of nanoparticles that you've ever seen, anybody has ever done, are spherical particles about 100 nanometers, it means that not only we don't know what's best, but we found out that we are all working with the absolute worst. I said, crap, no. Which is not to mean that liposomes are bad, abraxane are bad. It's great medicine, saved a lot of people, prolonged the life of a lot of people, fantastic drugs. I'm the strongest supporter. It just says that if you can actually come in with a little bit of math, a little bit of synthetic capabilities so that you can improve on your sizes and shapes and make them more, I don't want to say ideal, but just a little bit better. Chances are your concentration curves, your therapeutic indices will go up substantially. So that is the lesson. Same type of analysis, adhesion. Same story. So again, for the adhesion analysis, we did, you know, specific interactions like a receptor binding, non-specific with the van der Waals hydrostatic steric actions in this drug situation in linear flow. So do the analysis as you've seen. Oh, by the way, for margination, spherical is not only 10, 100 nanometers the worst, but spherical is of all sizes and shapes is the worst. Because once you get in the capillary wall, not by the wall, in the capillary, you stay there. You're not exploring, so you're stuck. So, I mean, we really have huge margins to improve on. So what is the lesson there? Well, the lesson there, I'm using this example to give you a pointer to one thing. How do you couple now the molecular, if you're looking at specific interactions, is antibody-antigen complexation, is ligand receptor complexation. You can use aptamers, you can use peptides, you can use whatever you want, but it still is a molecular recognition type of reaction that is going to be driving whether your adhesion is firm or not. How do you put that in the context of the continuum level analysis that we have used? And essentially, it comes down to using constitutive equations for the constants that govern the kinetics in terms of some of the macroscopic variables. That is the approach that we have taken. We have actually looked at it in two different ways. We looked at this from a probability analysis standpoint and a deterministic standpoint and found that they converge pretty much the same analysis. The mathematics for the probabilistic analysis was actually developed a long time ago by somebody that was good enough to do that, and we're happy to take advantage of this. So essentially what I'm going to be looking at here is the probability that a certain bond, that n bonds, will be activated, complexation between antibody and antigen will be activated. So the result is a prescriptive design rule, if you will, in the form of an adhesive strength probability of adhesion. Now, without going into too much detail, probability of adhesion, the likelihood that your particle will stick to where you want it to stick, can be expressed, not explicitly, in the context of this model, as a function of things, some of which you can image or analyze from your patient. And there are things that have to do with perhaps we can do imaging and understand and get some sort of an estimate for shear stress at the wall, which of course you cannot measure directly, but from flow analysis through imaging you can get some sort of an indicator for this. At the same time, surface receptor density is something that you can image through molecularly targeted contrast agents to some extent. But then, on the other side, you have your design, of course, your design variables. So these, you know out of your patient, and these you build into your particle. This is kind of the strategy. Remember, the way medicine has evolved in terms of drug development, this whole notion of personalizing therapy, is based on molecular recognition, on the ability to develop some sort of a targeting strategy for a cancer-specific pathway. Well, I got news, there is no such a thing. Or for a cancer-specific molecular expression on the cell surface. Well, I got news, there is no such a thing. There is expressions that are increased or decreased in a profile type of sense. So the notion of perhaps looking at flanking personalization through molecular biology with personalization through vector engineering, that's what we are championing, the revenge of the engineers, all right, if you will. And a few observations, I don't know that we have time to go through too many of those. Again, developed a mathematical model, this is mostly Paolo's work, and it turns out that, of course, you can observe and quantitate the collaborative, having more antibodies on the surface of a particle works better, obviously. You get one, the likelihood the next one will hook up. It's greater, so you get a collaborative effect, a cooperative effect, if you will. And adhesive is kind of interesting. Adhesive strength, actually, now you are looking at particles that have different aspect ratios. This is sphere, and then you're moving away from sphere, going all the way to this ellipsoid with an aspect ratio of 9. And you see that actually the probability parameter improves, and it allows you at the same probability of adhesion to deliver a greater amount of drug because it delivers a greater volume particle. So the short summary of that statement is that sphere is bad, disk is good, cylinder is good. Now the question is how do we make those things? And I will skip through the analysis of the more sophisticated shapes that we had to develop, other than to tell you that this thing here, unlikely as it may seem, is the best stiction probability particle that we were able to find. Again, it may be corresponding to a local minimum, there may be better ways to do this. This is the best we got so far. And then there is the whole story, how do particles get taken up by cells? There are many mechanisms for picking up particles. The overall, the rule of thumb is that small particles are picked up by receptor-mediated endocytosis through opsonins, which are pretty much unknown. However, larger particles are picked up by phagocytosis, which includes pretty large scale reorganization of the cytoskeleton, so a lot of mechanics takes care of that. And a great gentleman of mechanics has developed a fundamental theory of endocytosis of spherical particles, and we have built on that in a way that I will show you in a moment. Perhaps I will not show you in a moment. Other than to tell you that, and then you have these three distinct phenomena. You get three distinct design rules for margination, for adhesion, for, of course, endocytosis. Then you have to try to comprise them, to bring them together. And so the people at DARPA asked us, can you put together some sort of a periodic table of nanoparticles? And the answer is no, I can't. But perhaps we can put together, and that's something we started to publish, what we call design maps. Look more like phase diagrams, so that at the changing of specific and non-specific interaction for a given size and shape and material, there are too many parameters, you cannot put them all in a multi-dimensional graph, but this is a cut through this multi-dimensional space, you can actually see if your particle is gonna stick, it's gonna be taken up by your endothelial cells, perhaps it's something you want, because you want to collapse the angiogenic blood vessel. Perhaps it's something you don't want, endocytosis, so that you can go through to the other side and actually the cancer cells. We need both strategies. But that's kind of what we do. I'll show you a few pictures from the family album of pictures here of the babies. So far I've told you mathematics. Of course, in my group, we try to pursue the philosophy that we need to have the full cycle. We need to be able to do analysis. We need to be able to do synthesis. We need to have the biology to look at the cell level. We do animal level, and then we come back and recycle, and we actually have several outlets towards the clinic, but we don't have anything in the clinic yet. My group is about 60 people, actually a little bit more. I will put an advertisement out at the end. If anybody is looking for a job, we are expanding. We are really expanding, and we are having a ball. So these are the particles that we use. And surprise, we use silicon. Silicon. We started using silicon because that was the only material I knew to work with. I'll be honest about that. Turns out, now is the revenge of the silicon folks. Time. Silicon, nanoporous silicon, you see, we put in these nanopores to another process, can make it big and small. And if I put in enough nanopores, I can tailor the degradation rate. Silicon itself will not degrade. Nanoporous silicon reactivity at the surface goes through the roof. You tell me I want particles that degrade in 2 hours, in 6 hours, in 12 hours, in 3 days, in 6 months. I can do that. Degradation product, orthosilicic acid, at concentrations much lower than your dietary food intake. So very, unless you get crazy local concentrations, very, very safe. And the particles, you see, we make them with different porosities, and this the chemistry that governs these things is will also become the logics of release in a moment, as you will see. So in cross-section, some of the bigger pores in the crown, some of the lateral pores are actually a lot smaller. And so I can control the pore sizes. And no, believe me, they do degrade. I think I'm kind of running out of time, so let me rush through a couple of images here. Fascinating to see how these cells, these are endothelial cells. I have similar stories for macrophages, for any number of different cells, 17 different lines of endothelial cells. But the story is kind of this. Fascinating to see how cells will wrestle with these particles, like you and I wrestle with, you know, big sandwiches in the subway. Up, you turn them around and try to find the right angle to stick them in their mouth. And there are ways, and typically within a couple of hours, the native particles, as they are, boom, they get eaten up, and then they get degraded. But we are as I was saying, the process, this is clearly phagocytosis. You see pseudopodia coming out, being hugging, restructuring the cytoskeleton. It's fascinating. And they will actually pick them up. And now we are learning how to make it more or less appetizing for the cells. For different cells in different ways. Huh? Macrophages, professional phagocytes, they will eat you up no matter what, but sometimes they get delayed. Ubex cells, not supposed to be phagocytic, but believe me, you can trick them into eating stuff. You just have to make it appetizing enough, or you can make sure they don't get picked up at all by PEG, for instance. So, you know, again, it's a question of learning how to communicate with the cells. Now you see TEM, they tell you how the fate of the cells, they end up perinuclearly located, by and large, for reasons that I don't know, but it is endosomal transport. You actually even measure the speed of transport, so it's clearly endosomal, even though these things are pretty big. This looks like macropinocytosis, but it's phagocytosis, receptor-mediated as well. So it's multiple modes. Sorry, it is multiple modes. It is not a single mode. Now, the final part of the story is that these particles that you see right here carry, in this case, red is Q dots, optical contrast agents. Green is carbon nanotubes. No, we come from Rick Smalley's land. No, it's a Nobel laureate and Von Kerr for carbon nanotubes. We work very much with the people that carry on Rick's legacy. And you know, so see two different particles, they locate in different parts, remember the porosities are distributed differently. Why is that important? Because degradation is different in different sectors of the particle, so release is different. So I can literally build in a chemistry code in the particle that tells the particle, first release this family of nanoparticles, and second release the other family of nanoparticles, so that you have a time sequence action profile. And now you see how these particles actually, so these are DAPI stacks to show you where the nucleus is, the cell is all around here. These are the big particles and the quantum dots to see where they go. You see where there is some degree of colocalization between the quantum dots and the nanotubes, but it is not complete, so meaning that if you get smarter over time, we should be able to direct different payloads of nanoparticles to different locations, subcellularly at different times, with the different time sequence profiles. So that's learning to talk to cells at a very, very profound level, if you will. I'm very happy that this conference actually happens at this time, because we just put this out. He was the co-author of Nature Nanotech in the month of March. And here is Paolo Bicuzzi, here the mathematical hero of the whole story. Jim Tour is leads the laboratory of the used to be Dr. Smallis, and a bunch of the other people that you see. Silicon, biology, all sorts of wonderful people. And actually, in the very same issue of Nature, we put another article which combines evidence from our lab and others about the fact that geometry of the nanoparticles is not only important for these transport properties, but also has a direct effect on biological pathways such as AKT and MAP kinase. So by changing the geometry of your nanoparticle with the same material, you can induce or you can suppress things such as cell proliferation or apoptosis by geometry alone, not a passive mechanism. So in summary, and this actually made this current issue of Nature Nanotech carries this article where some of these things are also summarized. This is actually with the FDA. So we wrote this with the FDA. We had the workshop, and that's the report of that. Well, some of these I told you about say exactly that, not coincidentally. So the big opportunity for nanotechnology is to be able to negotiate the biological barriers, in my mind, by sequential or multi-action type of things. We couldn't think of anything better than multi-stage nanovectors, but I'm sure that a bunch of people will think of better things to use. Multiple payloads, imaging and therapy, for subcellular localizations by design, built in the chemistry of the particle, release profiles also controlled. Of course, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but I get carried away by enthusiasm, but you know, what you see the directions that we're looking at. Our stage one, which is the crucial stage, the taxi, is the photolithographically defined biodegradable nanoporous silicon, and the key of all of this is the rational design through mathematical methods of margination, adhesion, and endocytosis. There's no way that I can tell you this story that I was going to tell you, so another way, I'm always an optimist. So I would just by way of acknowledgments, at this, the laboratory, we have it's a great group, I hope you come and visit. We have three main lines. And these are some of the people here. I'm particularly pleased, you know, to show the different roles. So we have a computational mechanics person, Miloš Kojić and Fabio Hussein. Actually, we work a lot with Tom Hughes as well. You see, these are mathematicians. Paolo Vittorio is a biodistribution guy, very sophisticated mathematical skills, all the way from, I don't know what the heck I do anymore, but, you know, Fred is a molecular oncologist. And if you look at the postdocs, they come from all sorts of different pharmaceutical science and chemical engineering, biology, and all sorts of different things. So we are very happy with that environment. Oh, we are hiring. You notice the subliminal message. We are really great mathematicians. And this is the final slide. This is the story, the 2 years of the National Cancer Institute. And again, I looked at that as the greatest privilege. Was called in by the director, von Eschenbach, who's now the commissioner of the FDA. And essentially the conversation was, we heard this word nano. We don't know what the heck it is, but if it's any good, we want to use it against cancer. That was 2 years of my life then that we used to develop the plane. We launched in 2005. It still is the world's largest program in nanotechnology applied to medicine. They have a program that is going to be coming out of that sometime soon that specifically targets mathematics and physics against cancer. So please start thinking about that. There are tremendous opportunities for everybody. And just to give you an idea, again, album of family pictures here, this was my reference group. So my job was to go out and think ideas and discuss with the community and then come back and report. This was my sounding board. I don't know if you've seen these people, but no. This is James Watson, you know, the guy Watson and Crick. These two things together, I think it's 14 Nobel laureates. And this one, Eschenbach, and this Elias Zarrouni. This Lee Hartwell, Barmus, Bishop, you know, this is a bunch of tremendous people. So to me, without any merit whatsoever, but I felt very privileged, I had the opportunity to work with these people and help interface what, you know, much smarter than me people are doing, like you are yourselves in the trenches, and in whatever you do in mathematics and physics, with these colossals of biology type of folks. And with this, I thank you very much. I've spoken too long.